Dr. Fauci eventually recruited 400 U.S. hospitalized volunteers for NIAID's remdesivir trials, but despite this placebo chicanery, Dr. Fauci's researchers just couldn't get remdesivir to show any improvement in COVID survival. Despite its disappointing performance, Dr. Fauci worked hand-in-hand with Gilead's remdesivir team to guide the trial to a satisfactory outcome. According to Vera Sharov, the president and founder of the Alliance for Human Research Protection, AHRP, the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, NIAID, had complete control over the trial and made all decisions regarding trial design and implementation. Gilead Sciences employees participated in discussions about protocol development and in weekly protocol team calls with NIAID. Sharov's organization, Alliance for Human Research Protection, AHRP, monitors the quality and ethical performance of clinical trials. NIAID's remdesivir trial's original endpoint made sense. To win approval, the drug would need to demonstrate a reduction in COVID mortality. However, the drug didn't show the hoped-for benefit. While fewer patients receiving remdesivir died, those receiving remdesivir were also a lot less sick than the placebo subjects when they entered the trial. So Dr. Fauci's team decided to move the goalposts. The researchers, in fact, had changed the trial endpoints twice in an effort to create a meager appearance of benefit. Dr. Fauci's new endpoints allowed the drug to demonstrate a benefit, not by improving the chances of surviving COVID, but by achieving shorter hospital stays. Yet this too was a scam, because it turned out that almost twice as many remdesivir subjects as placebo subjects had to be readmitted to the hospital after discharge, suggesting that Fauci's improved time to recovery was due, at least in part, to discharging remdesivir patients prematurely. Altering protocols in the middle of an ongoing study is an interference commonly known as scientific fraud or falsification. UCLA epidemiology professor Sander Greenland explains, "You're not supposed to change your endpoint mid-course. That's frowned upon." Vera Sharov agrees, changing primary outcomes after a study has commenced is considered dubious and suspicious. But Dr. Fauci had little reason to worry that insiders would complain about the corruption of the study, since his trusted deputy, Cliff Lane, chaired the NIH Treatment Guidelines Panel. Lane was doubly conflicted, since he had personally overseen the remdesivir trials in China and stood potentially to share in patent rewards and royalties for the drug. In addition to Lane, 7 of the panel members had financial relationships with Gilead, and 8 additional panel members had had financial relationships with Gilead prior to the past 11 months, for which they were required to declare a relationship. "Is it any wonder remdesivir is the only drug recommended for COVID?" asks Vera Sharov, a Holocaust survivor who has devoted her life to advocating for ethics in the notoriously corrupt clinical trial industry. Before his study was completed or peer-reviewed, much less published, Dr. Fauci learned that The Lancet had just published a placebo-controlled Chinese study that showed remdesivir utterly ineffective at keeping hospitalized patients alive or reducing the duration of hospitalizations. Even more importantly, remdesivir did not reduce the presence of the virus in the blood. Worst of all, the Chinese study confirmed remdesivir's deadly toxicity. The Chinese regulators and researchers shuttered that trial because of potentially lethal side effects. Remdesivir caused serious injuries in 12% of the patients, compared to 5% of patients in the placebo group. Unlike Dr. Fauci's trial, the Chinese study was a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled, multi-center, peer-reviewed study published in the world's premier scientific journal, The Lancet. All the underlying data was available to the incurious press and the uninformed public. In contrast, Dr. Fauci's NIAID Gilead study was at that point still unpublished, not peer-reviewed, its details undisclosed. It employed a phony placebo and had suffered a sketchy mid-course protocol change. In April, the Chinese canceled two ongoing clinical trials with NIAID in China because the Chinese had succeeded in ending the COVID epidemic in the country, and researchers could no longer identify enough COVID patients to enroll in the study. In any event, the Chinese study spelled certain doom for remdesivir. It was now DOA at FDA, a poem title. But Dr. Fauci never accepted this. The inimitable maestro of regulatory combat responded to the crisis with savvy and bold action that would miraculously salvage his sinking product. He appeared at one of his regular White House press conferences, this one in the Oval Office. Seated on the couch next to Deborah Birx and opposite President Trump, Dr. Fauci made a surprise announcement. From that lofty platform, Dr. Fauci, with great fanfare, declared victory. The data from NIAID's clinical trial for remdesivir shows quite good news, he said, glossing over the drug's failure to demonstrate any mortality advantage. He boasted that the median time for hospitalization was 11 days for patients taking remdesivir, compared to 15 days in the placebo group. He told the credulous press, "The data shows that remdesivir has a clear-cut, significant, positive effect in diminishing the time to recovery." He claimed that his study had therefore proven remdesivir so remarkably beneficial to COVID patients that he had decided that it would be unethical to deny Americans benefits of this wonder drug. He was, he declared, unblinding and ending the study and giving remdesivir to the placebo group. Remdesivir would be America's new standard of care for COVID. It was, of course, all a lie. On May 1st, the FDA granted the pandemic's first emergency use authorization for a COVID drug, allowing remdesivir treatments for patients hospitalized with severe COVID-19. Based on Dr. Fauci's representation, President Trump purchased the world's entire stock of remdesivir for Americans. The European Union signed a joint procurement agreement with Gilead to queue up in the pipeline for 500,000 treatment courses. The day after Dr. Fauci's announcement at the White House, the University of North Carolina issued a press release headlined "Remdesivir, developed through a UNC Chapel Hill partnership, proves effective against COVID-19 in NIAID human clinical trials." Dr. Fauci's gain-of-function wizard, Dr. Rolf Barrick, called this a game-changer for the treatment of patients with COVID-19. Vera Sharov points out that in a rational universe, a poison like remdesivir would have no hope of winning regulatory approval, unless, of course, the company could somehow distract attention from the overwhelmingly catastrophic scientific evidence by getting the world's most powerful health official, the man who conducted the clinical trial, to pronounce the drug a miracle cure at a globally attended press conference while lounging on an Oval Office divan beside the President of the United States. Says Sharov, "What better free advertisement?" Sharov adds, "Dr. Fauci had a vested interest in remdesivir. He sponsored the clinical trial, whose detailed results were not subject to the peer review he demanded for the drugs he regarded as rivals, like hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin. Instead of showing transparent data and convincing results, he did science by fiat. He simply declared the disappointing results to be highly significant and pronounced remdesivir to be the new standard of care." Fauci made the promotional pronouncement while sitting on a couch in the White House, without providing a detailed news release, without a briefing at a medical meeting or peer review for publication in a scientific journal, as is the norm in practice, to allow scientists and researchers to review the data. Standard of care. FDA's recognition of remdesivir as the new standard of care for COVID meant that Medicaid and insurance companies could not legally deny it to patients and would have to fork over Gilead's exorbitant price tag on a product U.S. taxpayers had by then spent at least $85 million to develop. Improving Gilead's business even more, doctors and hospitals that failed to use remdesivir could now be sued for malpractice, leading some medical experts to believe that coercing the use of this worthless and dangerous drug on COVID patients almost certainly cost tens of thousands of Americans their lives. As we shall see, Dr. Fauci copied the choreographed script for winning remdesivir's EUA from the worn, rabbit-eared playbook that he developed during his early AIDS years and then used repeatedly across his career to win approvals for deadly and ineffective drugs. Time and again, he has terminated clinical trials of his sweetheart drugs the moment they begin to reveal cataclysmic toxicity. He makes the absurd claim that his drug du jour had proven so miraculously effective that it would be unethical to deny it to the public, and then he strong-arms FDA to grant his approvals. This time only, the brazenness of the fraud earned Dr. Fauci some rare criticism, even in mainstream science and press, and from academic institutions that customarily maintain silence about his shenanigans, given their addictions to whopping NIH and BMGF funding. On October 24, 2020, Umer Irfan noted that the FDA is once again promoting a COVID-19 therapy based on shaky evidence. The British Medical Journal pointed out, none of the randomized controlled trials published so far, however, have shown that remdesivir saves significantly more lives than standard medical care. Eric Topol of Scripps Research Translational Institute scolded that this is a very, very bad look for the FDA, and the dealings between Gilead and EU make it another layer of badness. Angela Rasmussen, a virologist at Columbia University Mailman School of Public Health, told a reporter, "I was really surprised when I saw that news." Science magazine said Dr. Fauci's move had baffled scientists who have closely watched the clinical trials of remdesivir unfold over the past 6 months and who have many questions about remdesivir's worth. University of Oxford professor of clinical therapeutics Duncan Richard scathingly observed that research based on this kind of use should be treated with extreme caution because there is no control group or randomization, which are some of the hallmarks of good practice in clinical trials. Professor Stephen Evans in pharmacoepidemiology at the Gates-funded London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine offered a particularly scathing assessment. The data from this paper are almost uninterpretable. It is very surprising, perhaps even unethical, that the New England Journal of Medicine has published it. It would be more appropriate to publish the data on the website of the pharmaceutical company that has sponsored and written up the study. At least Gilead has been clear that this has not been done in the way that a high-quality scientific paper would be written. Even Bill Gates raised an eyebrow about the audacity of the caper. When Wired magazine in August 2020 asked Gates what therapeutic treatment he'd ask for if hospitalized with COVID-19, he did not hesitate. "Remdesivir," Gates replied, adding a comment that put daylight between him and the embarrassing clinical trial fiasco. Sadly, the trials in the U.S. have been so chaotic that the actual proven effect is kind of small. Potentially, the effect is much larger than that. It's insane how confused the trials here in the U.S. have been. Then, on October 19, 2020, 3 days before remdesivir's FDA approval, the World Health Organization published a definitive study on remdesivir involving 11,266 COVID-19 patients in 405 hospitals and 30 countries. The power of this study dwarfed the Fauci-Gilead project, which had recruited 1,062 patients. In the WHO's trial, remdesivir failed to reduce mortality and failed to reduce the need for ventilators or the length of hospital stays. WHO researchers found no detectable benefits from remdesivir and recommended against its use in COVID-19 patients. WHO published its devastating indictment of remdesivir 1 month after FDA issued the remdesivir EUA for children less than 12 years of age. Dr. Fauci and the FDA knew about the WHO study before the FDA issued the EUA for remdesivir and almost certainly read the preprints and understood the findings. It appears, in fact, that Dr. Fauci once again hurried the approval through FDA so as to beat the publication of a negative study. On July 15, 2021, a large Johns Hopkins study in original investigation infectious diseases once again confirmed that remdesivir treatment was not associated with improved survival, but was associated with longer hospital stays. On October 2, 2020, the European Union released its own safety review of remdesivir. The study reported serious side effects. Every independent randomized control trial of remdesivir has shown either a lack of benefit or a clear trend to harm, says Dr. Pierre Corey. It's only those two pharma studies with Dr. Fauci that show any benefits, and even then, the benefits are minor. It makes no sense to give an antiviral in late stages of a viral infection, Dr. Corey adds. The viral replication mainly takes place prior to day 7. If an antiviral works, that's when you administer antivirals. Remdesivir might work early on, but we don't know because it's IV administered, and you can't really do that to ambulatory patients. A remedy worse than the malady. From early in May 2020, doctors and hospitals began using remdesivir on hospitalized patients who tested positive for COVID in PCR tests. By November 9, 2021, the publication date of this book, CDC's website lists only two drugs approved for treating COVID-19, remdesivir and the corticosteroid dexamethasone. Doctors often use the two drugs in conjunction. Assessing remdesivir's impact on hospitalized COVID-19 patients is difficult, in part because, like COVID-19, remdesivir causes extreme toxicity to lungs and kidneys and mimics several of the other lethal symptoms of COVID, including multi-organ failure. Many doctors believe our country's record COVID-19 fatalities are at least in part due to widespread use of remdesivir in 2020. We had the most deaths worldwide, says Dr. Ryan Cole. It's a haunting question. How many of these Americans were remdesivir casualties? For several months, we were the only country treating people with a drug proven to be lethal. That year, 2020, we had almost double the number of deaths per month compared to most other countries. Brazil, one of the first nations to widely use remdesivir, had the second highest death toll. In May of 2020, New York doctors repeatedly marveled at the tendency for COVID-19 to cause kidney failure, something that no other respiratory virus does. Doctors began seeing acute kidney failure on day 3, 4, and 5 after admission. Hospitals short on ventilators also ran out of dialysis machines. Physician and laboratory CEO Dr. Ryan Cole is one of many doctors who believe that many of those cases were attributable to remdesivir. COVID-19 can affect the kidneys, he says. We know this because we can recover the spike protein from urine, but it's dubious that the sheer magnitude of acute renal failure we saw among hospitalized COVID patients can all be attributed solely to the coronavirus infection. Dr. Cole told me that in the animal studies, 1/4 of the animals died from kidney failure. He explains that kidney collapse can lead to fluid accumulations in the lungs and everywhere, and results in multi-organ failure and sepsis, all of which are also sequelae of COVID. Remdesivir shouldn't be on the market, he added. Dr. Fauci's 2019 Ebola study proved that remdesivir by day 3, 4, and 5 caused acute kidney failure in upwards of 31% of patients. In less than 5 days of remdesivir treatment, 8% of all people died or experienced life-threatening multiple organ failure or kidney failure so severe they had to be taken off the drug. So it may not be a coincidence that roughly the same number of hospitalized COVID patients, 8 to 10 times, were dying in the first week, says Cole. Dr. McCullough gives us a stark and clear summary. Remdesivir has two problems. First, it doesn't work. Second, it is toxic and it kills people. 5. Final solution. Vaccines or bust. The only means to fight a plague is honesty. Albert Camus, The Plague, 1947. During the spring of 2020, Dr. Fauci and Bill Gates carpet-bombed the airwaves, bearishly predicting that a miraculous vaccine would stop COVID transmission, prevent illness and the pandemic, and release humanity from house arrest. Even vaccinology's most stalwart tub-thumpers, true believers like Dr. Peter Hotez and Dr. Paul Offit, regarded those forecasts as far-fetched and foolhardy. After all, for decades, two perilous and seemingly insurmountable impediments had thwarted every attempt to craft a coronavirus vaccine. Leaky vaccines. The first obstacle was the coronavirus's tendency to rapidly mutate, producing vaccine-resistant variants. Vaccine developers like Hotez and Offit doubted that after decades of futile efforts, researchers could suddenly develop a COVID vaccine that would provide sterilizing immunity, meaning that it would completely obliterate viral colonies in vaccinated individuals and prevent transmission and mutation. As if to confirm such fears, in May of that year, Britain's top vaccinologist, Andrew Pollard, admitted that the Oxford University's government-funded and patriotically ballyhooed AstraZeneca vaccine had failed to achieve sterilizing immunity in monkeys. The inoculated macaques, even when asymptomatic, continued to support high viral loads in their nasal pharynxes. Then, in August, Dr. Fauci primped up the dismaying news of similar failures by all the competing candidates with a kind of celebratory bravado. Instead of declaring defeat and retreating to the drawing board, Dr. Fauci cheerfully announced that none of the first-generation COVID vaccines was likely to prevent transmission. That news should have cratered the entire project. Leading virologists, including Nobel laureate Luc Montagnier, pointed out that a non-sterilizing or leaky vaccine could not arrest transmission and would therefore fail to stop the pandemic. Even worse, vaccinated individuals, he warned, would become asymptomatic carriers and mutant factories, blasting out vaccine-resistant versions of the disease that were likely to lengthen and intensify rather than abbreviate the pandemic. But Tony Fauci and his partner, Bill Gates, seemed to have a strategy for neutralizing the variant threat. The two men had put billions of taxpayer and tax-deducted dollars into developing an mRNA platform for vaccines that, in theory, would allow them to quickly produce new boosters to combat each new escape variant. This scheme was Big Pharma's holy grail. Vaccines are one of the rare commercial products that multiply profits by failing. Each new booster doubles the revenues from the initial jab. Since NIAID co-owned the mRNA patent, the agency stood to make billions from its coronavirus gambit by producing successive boosters for every new variant. The more, the better. The good news for pharma was that all of humanity would be permanently dependent on biannual or even triannual booster shots. Dr. Peter McCullough warned that mass vaccination with a leaky vaccine during a pandemic would put the world on a never-ending booster treadmill. That kind of talk had pharma popping champagne corks. In October 2021, Pfizer announced that it was projecting an astonishing $26 billion in revenues from its COVID boosters. Pathogenic priming. The even more daunting obstacle to coronavirus vaccines was their tendency to induce pathogenic priming, also known as antibody-dependent enhancement, ADE, an overstimulation of immune system response that can cause severe injuries and death when vaccinated individuals subsequently encounter the wild viruses. In early experiments, coronavirus vaccines produced a robust immune response in both animals and children, temporarily heartening researchers, but then tragically killing the vaccine recipients upon re-exposure to the wild virus or making them vulnerable to uniquely debilitating infections. Early in 2020, vaccinology's most brass-bound commissars warned of this pitfall as Dr. Fauci unleashed the industry with billions in federal lucre to gin up COVID inoculations at record pace. In his March 5, 2020 testimony before the House Science, Space, and Technology Committee on Coronavirus, Bill Gates's paid mouthpiece, Dr. Peter Hotez, cautioned, "One of the things we're not hearing a lot about is the unique potential safety problem of coronavirus vaccines. With certain types of respiratory virus vaccines, you get immunized, and then, when you get actually exposed to the virus, you get this kind of paradoxical immune enhancement phenomenon." Dr. Hotez confessed to the committee that his colleagues had killed a number of children from pathogenic priming during experiments with the respiratory syncytial virus, RSV, vaccines in 1966, and recounted that during his own earlier work on coronavirus vaccines, he saw the same effect on ferrets. "We started developing coronavirus vaccines, and our colleagues, we noticed in laboratory animals that they started to show some of the same immune pathology. So we said, oh my God, this is going to be problematic." In an April 26, 2020 interview with pharma troll Dr. Zubin Z-Dog Damania, MD, Merck's top vaccine promoter, Dr. Paul Offit amplified these concerns. "Binding antibodies can be dangerous and cause something called antibody-dependent enhancement, and we've seen that. I mean, we saw that with the Gates-funded dengue vaccine. But with the dengue vaccine, in children who had never been exposed to dengue before, it actually made them worse when they were then exposed to the natural virus. Much worse. Vaccinated children who were less than 9 years of age, who had never been exposed to dengue before, were more likely to die if they'd been vaccinated than if they hadn't been vaccinated." And even Dr. Anthony Fauci, during his March 26, 2020 White House coronavirus briefing, acknowledge the perils of pathogenic priming. "The issue of safety is something I want to make sure the American public understands. Does the vaccine make you worse? And there are diseases in which you vaccinate someone, they get infected with what you're trying to protect them with, and you actually enhance the infection. That's the worst possible thing you could do, is vaccinate somebody to prevent infection and actually make them worse." Dr. Fauci must have recognized that since vaccine makers had immunity from liability, which he had helped arrange, and were playing, as it were, with house money, which he diverted to them through NIH, these companies had little incentive to invest in the kind of long-term studies necessary to eliminate the pathogenic priming hazard. In retrospect, it seems that Dr. Fauci and his confederates had at least 6 strategies for dealing with this grim risk. All 6 tactics involved hiding the evidence of ADE if it did occur. Dr. Fauci's first approach was to abort the 3-year clinical trials at 6 months and then vaccinate the controls, a preemption that would prevent detection of long-term injuries, including pathogenic priming. Regulators initially intended the Pfizer vaccine trial to continue for 3 full years until May 2, 2023. Because the FDA allowed Pfizer to unblind and terminate its study after 6 months, and to offer the vaccine to individuals in the placebo group, we will never know whether vaccinated individuals in the trial suffered long-term injuries, including pathogenic priming, that canceled out short-term benefits. Science and experience tell us that many vaccines can cause injuries like cancers, autoimmune diseases, allergies, fertility problems, and neurological illnesses with long-term diagnostic horizons or long incubation periods. A 6-month study will hide these harms. Second, as COVID czar, Dr. Fauci stubbornly refused to fix HHS's designed-to-fail vaccine injury surveillance system, VAERS, which systematically suppresses reporting of most vaccine injuries. The Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System is a passive, voluntary system jointly managed by the CDC and FDA that accepts reports from anyone. A 2010 HHS study of the government's notoriously dysfunctional VAERS concluded that VAERS detects fewer than 1% of vaccine injuries. Put another way, VAERS misses over 99% of vaccine injuries, thereby lending the illusion of safety to even the most deadly inoculations. In 2010, the Federal Agency for Healthcare Research Quality, AHRQ, designed and field-tested a state-of-the-art machine-counting AI system as an efficient alternative to VAERS. By testing the system for several years on the Harvard Pilgrim HMO, AHRQ proved that it could capture most vaccine injuries. AHRQ initially planned to roll out the system to all remaining HMOs, but after seeing the AHRQ's frightening results, vaccines were causing serious injuries in 1 of every 40 recipients. CDC killed the project and stowed the new system on a dusty shelf. Dr. Fauci left that system safely cached throughout the pandemic, allowing HHS's broken voluntary system to continue to conceal vaccine injuries, including any evidence of pathogenic priming. Third, Dr. Fauci's trump card was his capacity to enlist mainstream and social media companies to make reporting of injuries and deaths disappear from the airwaves, newspapers, and the internet, and therefore from the public consciousness. Facebook, Google, and the television networks purged doctors and scientists who reported pathogenic priming and censored reports about the waves of other vaccine injuries. As a federal official sworn for 4 decades to uphold the Constitution, Dr. Fauci should have been the champion of free speech and vigorous debate during the pandemic. Instead, he worked hand in glove with Bill Gates, Mark Zuckerberg, and other big tech titans to censor criticism of his various mandates and suppress information about vaccine injuries, including discussions of pathogenic priming. Email traffic shows that Dr. Fauci colluded directly with Mark Zuckerberg and the social media platforms to censor doctors who reported vaccine failures, harms, and deaths, to deplatform public health advocates like myself, and to evict and muzzle patients who reported their own injuries. The science journals, utterly dependent on pharma advertising, obligingly refused to publish studies on the rash of deadly and debilitating jab reactions. The Bill Gates-funded fact-checking organization, PolitiFact, worked with pharma-funded fact-checkers like FactCheck, which receives funding from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and whose current CEO is Richard Besser, former acting head of the CDC, which owns $1.8 billion in Johnson & Johnson stock, to debunk stories and studies of vaccine injuries. On October 7, 2021, Dr. Robert Malone, the inventor of the mRNA vaccine, complained in a tweet that America's people were almost utterly blind to the floods of adverse vaccine events that were killing and debilitating their countrymen. The real problem here is the damn press and the internet giants. The press and these tech players act to manufacture and reinforce consensus around selected and approved narratives. And then this is being weaponized to attack dissenters, including highly qualified physicians. Fourth, Dr. Fauci allowed CDC to discourage autopsies in deaths following vaccination. CDC refused to recommend autopsies on deaths reported to VAERS. That omission allowed the agency to repeatedly make the audacious, fraudulent declaration that all the 16,000 reported deaths following vaccination by October 2021 were unrelated to the vaccines. The regulatory agencies thereby abolished vaccine deaths and injuries by fiat. Instead of exposing this sort of rank deception by government authorities, media and social media enablers emboldened HHS to new nadirs in regulatory malpractice. In January of 2021, baseball superstar Hank Aaron, whom I knew, died 17 days after receiving the COVID jab at a CDC-sponsored press conference in Atlanta. I observed in a Defender article that Aaron's death was one of a wave of deaths among the elderly following COVID jabs. This was true, but the New York Times nevertheless vilified me for spreading misinformation and claimed that the Fulton County coroner had determined that Aaron's death was unrelated to vaccines. USA Today, Newsweek, Time, Daily Beast, ABC, CNN, and CBS reported the Times claim. But when I called to verify their claim, the Fulton County coroner told me that the office has never seen Aaron's body and that no autopsy was ever performed. Aaron's family had buried the home run hero without a postmortem. The Times fabrication was part of the systematic campaign of deception, propaganda, and censorship by HHS regulators in partnership with mainstream media, almost unprecedented in the American experience, that helped conceal the tsunami of vaccine injuries and fatalities. Anthony Fauci is a great guy, in the same way that Harvey Weinstein was a great guy, says Jeff Hansen, the chairman of a large publicly traded healthcare corporation. It all changed when widespread private knowledge about him crossed the transom into public knowledge. Weinstein, too, had powerful mainstream media outfits watching his back. Incidentally, autopsy reports from other nations are revealing exactly the sorts of information that CDC understandably wants to protect Americans from learning. In September 2021, veteran German pathologists and professors Dr. Arne Burkhardt, who served as director of the Institute of Pathology in Reutlingen for 18 years, and Dr. Walter Lang, chief of a leading lung pathology institute for 35 years, performed autopsies on 10 cadavers of individuals who died following vaccination, finding that 5 were very likely and 2 more probably related to the jab. In 3 cases, they found strong evidence of lethal multisystem inflammation and runaway autoimmunity, including rare autoimmune diseases like Hashimoto's, an autoimmune-triggered hypothyroidism, leukoclastic vasculitis, an inflammatory reaction in the capillaries that leads to skin bleeding, and Sjogren's syndrome, an inflammation of the salivary and lacrimal glands. 3 autoimmune diseases in a total of 10 is a strikingly high rate, said Professor Lang. The doctors also found large clusters of endothelial cells detached from the walls of blood vessels, and clumps of red blood cells that cause thrombosis, and giant cells that formed around trapped foreign bodies. Lange said he had not seen anything like these clusters of lymphocytes in hundreds of thousands of pathological studies. The lymphocytes are running amok in all organs. Lange faulted government regulators for hindering autopsies on vaccine reactions. We are missing out on 90%. Fifth, Dr. Fauci populated the key FDA and CDC committees with NIAID, NIH, and Gates Foundation grantees and loyalists to ensure rubber-stamp approvals for his mRNA vaccines without any long-term injury studies. More than half of FDA's VRBPAC committee, which approved EUAs for Moderna, Johnson & Johnson, and Pfizer, and granted final licensure to the Pfizer vaccine, were grant recipients from NIH, NIAID, BMGF, and pharmaceutical companies. More than half the CDC's ACIP committee participants were similarly compromised. Sixth, by vaccinating the entire population, Dr. Fauci seems to be striving to eliminate the control group to hide vaccine injuries. In a 2015 interview, Dr. Fauci said, "I mean, if a parent really feels strongly against vaccination, that parent can get an exemption. So there's never a situation where someone is going to tie you down and vaccinate you or say you can't go to any schools at all if you're not vaccinated. Nowhere should you force someone to do anything." In the run-up to the rollout, Dr. Fauci frequently repeated his ethical antipathy against mandating vaccination. But once the voluntary market reached saturation, those scruples melted away, and following his guidance, the federal policies began treating the vaccine hesitant as dangerous public enemies. "Our patience is wearing thin," warned Joe Biden during a national address on September 9, 2021. Dr. Fauci presided over a progression of increasingly draconian forms of coercion to compel vaccination of the entire population. With his open encouragement, universities, schools, businesses, hospitals, public employers, and a litany of other societal power centers simultaneously launched numbing waves of strong-arm tactics to compel unwilling Americans to submit to vaccination, including threats of discrimination, job loss, exclusion from schools, parks, sports and entertainment venues, bars, restaurants, military service, public employment, travel, and health care. The unvaccinated experienced exclusion, marginalization, vilification, purges by social media platforms and mainstream media, as well as threats of violence, incarceration, legal reprisals, and deprivation of rights. In October 2021, New York Governor Kathy Hochul promised to deny driver's licenses and automobile registration to the unvaccinated. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio threatened to exclude the unvaccinated from subways, gyms, bars, and businesses. A Colorado hospital announced the removal of unvaccinated patients from its lists of those eligible for organ transplants. Observing that some 25% of African Americans were unvaccinated, civil rights leader Kevin Jenkins declared, "This is the new Jim Crow." Whether intentional or not, the effect of this escalation was, increasingly, to eliminate the control group, which, coincidentally, would permanently hide the evidence of vaccine injuries. This motivation alone explains Dr. Fauci's reckless and ferocious drive to vaccinate every last American, even those who have natural immunity and nothing to gain from vaccination. Americans below 50, even kindergarten-age children with zero risk from COVID, and pregnant women, despite a nearly complete lack of information about the jab's impact on the fetus. Dr. Fauci continued to insist that fully vaccinating the entire population was the only path to ending the pandemic. This assertion ignored the fact that COVID vaccines prevent neither transmission nor infection, nor reductions in viral loads. Overwhelming science has proven that vaccinated and unvaccinated individuals are equally likely to spread disease. A September 2021 Israeli study demonstrating that natural immunity provides 27 times better protection against COVID than the Pfizer vaccine is just one of 29 recently published peer-reviewed studies that vouch for the superiority of natural immunity. What, then, is motivating the fierce campaign to nevertheless coercively vaccinate the vaccine-resistant 25%, other than a strategy to eliminate the control group to hide the deaths and injuries? By November 2021, that retinue of concerning devices largely succeeded in concealing from Americans the well-established facts that Dr. Fauci's vaccines neither prevented the disease nor its transmission, and that COVID vaccines were killing and injuring record numbers of Americans. The relentless broadcast of frightening and purposefully inflated COVID death reports stoked fears of the contagion that convinced many Americans to believe the government's mantra that COVID vaccines were safe and effective, and that to the extent they weren't, the vaccines cause more good than harm. Physicians and scientists complained that Dr. Fauci's vaccine promotions constituted a vast, unprecedented population-wide experiment with shady record-keeping and no control group. Meanwhile, the actual data suggested that the COVID vaccines were causing far more deaths than they were averting. The Pfizer vaccine, a cold look at the shocking data. At this book's November 2021 publication date, only Pfizer's COVID vaccine, known as Comirnaty, had won FDA approval. Although Comirnaty is not yet given in the United States, its counterpart, the Pfizer BioNTech, the same vaccine under a different name, is, so I will focus on the Pfizer BioNTech vaccine. As of October 6th, U.S. health officials had administered more than 230 million doses of Pfizer's COVID vaccine, compared to 152 million doses of Moderna and 15 million doses of Johnson & Johnson. The final summary of the Pfizer's six-month clinical trial data, the document that Pfizer submitted to FDA to win approval, revealed one key data point that should have killed that intervention forever. Far more people died in the vaccine group than in the placebo group during Pfizer's clinical trials. The fact that FDA nevertheless granted Pfizer full approval and that the medical community embraced and prescribed this intervention for their patients is eloquent testimony to the resilience of even the most deadly and inefficacious products and the breathtaking power of the pharmaceutical industry and its government allies to control the narrative through captive regulators, compliant physicians, and media manipulation, and to overwhelm the fundamental common sense of much of humanity. The Pfizer vaccine trial offers a lesson on the perils of ignoring all-cause mortality as the governing endpoint for vaccine approval. But before we talk about all-cause mortality, let's look at the evidence that convinced FDA to grant Pfizer its license. Mathematical chicanery, relative risk versus absolute risk. Pfizer's final report to FDA summarizes death data from Pfizer's six-month clinical trial. The study by then was unblinded and over. Pfizer won FDA's approval, despite the rather pathetic showing that its vaccine might prevent one COVID death in every 22,000 vaccine recipients. So, how did Pfizer transform its unimpressive record of eliminating a single COVID fatality among 22,000 vaccinated subjects into a $5 billion a year success story? By gulling the public with a deceptive measure called relative risk instead of the presumptive and far more useful measure of absolute risk. During the 6-month trial, 2 people in the placebo group, numbering approximately 22,000, and only 1 in the similarly sized vaccine group died from COVID. Believe it or not, this data point is the source of Pfizer's claim that the vaccine is 100% efficacious against death. Since only 1 person died from COVID in the vaccine group and 2 died in the placebo group, Pfizer can technically represent that the vaccine is a 100% improvement over the placebo. After all, the number 2 is 100% greater than the number 1, right? The media winked at this canard, obligingly reporting Pfizer's extraordinary 100% efficacy claim. At least some reporters must have understood that most Americans hearing this statistic would naturally believe that the vaccine would prevent 100% of deaths. A more honest and helpful way of thinking about the Pfizer vaccine's efficacy is to consider that 22,000 vaccines must be given to save a single life from COVID. Equally concerning, every virologist and infectious disease expert knew that the true reduction in risk of 1 in 22,000, or about 0.01%, as the BMJ reported, was far too insignificant to make the vaccine even a minor barrier against the spread of COVID. It's axiomatic that any vaccine that does not prevent transmission and that spares only 1 in 22,000 from death from the target contagion has no ability to stop a pandemic. Because the clinical trial showed that vaccines reduce absolute risk less than 1%, see Brown, R., and colleagues from Waterloo in Canada, those vaccines can't possibly influence epidemic curves. It's mathematically impossible, explains Peter McCullough. Nevertheless, Dr. Fauci continued to promote the vaccine as the ultimate panacea. The entire justification that Gates and Dr. Fauci had been trumpeting for a year, that their vaccines would end the pandemic, was now so much exploded shrapnel. Nevertheless, Dr. Fauci continued to claim that full vaccination of the entire population was the only way to end the pandemic. He thereby justified his insistence that Americans submit to mass vaccination. But the story gets even worse. The meager advantage of preventing a single COVID death in 1 out of every 22,000 vaccinated individuals is entirely canceled out by a 5-fold increase in excess fatal cardiac arrests and congestive heart failures in vaccinated individuals. Pfizer and its regulatory magician, Dr. Fauci, used smoke and mirrors to divert public attention from this all-important question of all-cause mortality. All-cause mortality. All-cause mortality should be the key metric in weighing the value of any medical intervention. That measure alone tells us whether vaccinated individuals enjoy better outcomes and longer lives than the unvaccinated. Drugs and vaccines that appear at first glance effective against the target disease may, over longer terms, trigger deaths from unexpected causes, accidents, cancers, heart attacks, seizures, even depression and suicide, or from pathogenic priming, which cancel out the short-term benefits of the intervention. As we shall see in the next 2 chapters, Dr. Fauci learned at the outset of his career to find excuses for abbreviating clinical trials of toxic medications to keep long-term mortalities invisible and to cloud overall cost-benefit assessments. Pfizer's 6-month clinical data for its COVID vaccine trials suggested that, while the vaccine would avert a single death from COVID-19, the vaccinated group suffered 4 times the number of lethal heart attacks as the unvaccinated. In other words, there was no mortality benefit from the vaccines. for every life saved from COVID, there were 4 excess heart attack fatalities. 20 people died of all-cause mortality among the 22,000 recipients in Pfizer's vaccine group, versus only 14 in the numerically comparable placebo group. Pfizer was evidently so alarmed by the total number of deaths in its vaccine cohort that it only disclosed them in fine print, buried in the body of its report. That means there were 42.8% more deaths in the vaccine than in the placebo groups. Under FDA guidelines, researchers must attribute all injuries and deaths among the study group during clinical trials to the intervention, the vaccine, unless proven otherwise. Under this rule, the FDA must assume people who take the vaccine have 42.8% increased risk of dying. This 6-month safety report was so damning that it should have closed the case against this vaccine, but captured FDA officials nevertheless gave Pfizer their approval. The broken VAERS system and the mainstream and social media all conspired to conceal the evidence of the crime when vaccinated Americans began dying in droves, and CDC implemented its own retinue of enshrouding machinations to cloak the real-life carnage.